Hey, Bill.
Good morning. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Bill. Welcome to the DMZ Scandal Week edition.
So I have a minor surprise for you.
What's that?
So I host the Northampton Drinking Liberally chapter every Tuesday night. And for those who don't know, Drinking Liberally is a nationwide, you know, network of drinking clubs. So it's, you know, it's very loose.
I support your liberalism in this regard.
I do drink water at my Drinking Liberally event.
So. Of course you do.
I had a new person come last night who is a DMZ fan.
Very cool. You know, before you go there, let me just say I am frequently surprised, happily surprised, that people know who I am, and a lot of times it's through this show that there are fans.
Well, I mean, I imagine you must run into people more often. One, I think you're a very prominent conservative circles,
oh, yes.
And you're in the soup in the Beltway. You know, I don't have as many chance encounters in Western Massachusetts about political stuff. So it's novel for me that someone would actually recognize me for being on the DMZ. So that was a nice surprise for me last night to talk to a fan.
Well, tell me, I mean, not fishing for compliments here, but was it a liberal, I assume? And what was there anything that this person liked specifically about me?
I mean, I think he liked it for the reasons why we do it. He liked, I mean, yes, he's a liberal, but he thought we had good civil conversation. He thought you were an on the level conservative. He said we were his second favorite blogging head show. We were behind Dan Dresner and Heather Hulbert. So you know, we can't get too over the moon about it, but still.
Well, it's nice. It is sort of the backhanded compliment. You're my second favorite blogging head show. You should lie. If you actually meet the person on the show, have the decency to lie. Tell us that we're your
favorite. Well, but the worst thing is, when you wasn't like, just saying it to be nice to me.
When it's like a hot chick and she's like, my mom is a huge fan of yours. So will you sign this autograph, this book for my mom? She's old. She's 37. Yeah, that's not what you want. But anyway, I'm glad that we're the second favorite show. That's good. I'm okay with that.
So on our last DMZ, we left on a cliffhanger. We came to fierce blows. The whole premise of the DMZ was hanging by a thread. Could Matt and Bill, could we live together without driving each other crazy in the midst of Scandal Week? How have you been handling the aftermath of our soap opera?
Well, I'm doing okay. We did have some friends and fans on Twitter who were a little concerned that there could be a spat between us. But I think we made it. I do want to talk about how this scandal has affected me personally.
That is what the nation is worried about.
I think with bated breath. And so I do want to do some navel gazing and some bitching and complaining because, look, let's be honest. This actually speaks to my problem, which is that, like, what can we say on this show that Jake Tapper isn't going to say about the scandal, which is everyone's talking about these scandals. So what am I going to, what I'm going to call my sources at the Pentagon that didn't talk to, that aren't talking to James Rosen or whomever instead of me. This sort of undermines my competitive advantage here, and I'm very upset about it. As I was telling you off the air, I feel like there are three things that I do that I bring to the table, all of which have been difficult. And look, we're professionals at this, which means that like we have to write whether it's a good season or a bad season. We have to go fishing whether the fish are biting. And you might assume that this is a great time to be a center-right journalist. But interestingly, there are challenges. I've written some things this week we're going to talk about later that I think have gone nowhere because I think they're being overshadowed. But, Bill, I think there are three things that I do, all of which are undermined by the scandal. One is conservative truth-telling. So, for example, when the mainstream media is not covering something adequately, say like the Gosnell case, I can sort of highlight that story and hope, try to push it and the mainstream try to shame the media. But what can I do? They are covering this. They're anxiously covering this scandal, so I can't really do that. I can't be the, you know. The other thing that I do sometimes is conservative truth-telling / navel-gazing, where I will call out my side. But in this case, not only I don't necessarily think there's anything to call them out for right now, number one, and number two, it would not be a very hospitable environment. It would be a very inhospitable environment for me with Obama on the ropes to do a whole lot of, yeah, but let's talk about whatever. And that brings me to my third point, is the quirky offbeat things that I like to write about that are a little different, you know, theology, philosophy, whatever, things that aren't necessarily the kind of stuff that most political writers cover, where I inject history or theology or whatever into it. Not a big appetite for that right now either. And so I'm effectively shut down, and instead of talking about Lois Lerner, who is taking the fifth as we speak, I have been given the fifth by my readers. I've been told to keep quiet in case I might incriminate myself. So that's my complaint, Bill. You're a professional. You got to do this whether anyone cares or not. How do you cope through the good times and the bad?
Well, I mean, I feel I'm in somewhat of a similar boat as you in that just my general MO is not to, you know, jump into these pile-ons.
Right.
Just because I just don't feel constitutionally interested in it half the time. I feel like, what am I going to say that isn't already being said by somebody else? I mean, the value you're trying to bring is, what can I say that's different, that's value-added? And the amount of time it would take me to catch up on all the intricacies of it, to think of something new to say, by the time I do that, probably five other people are going to say it.
Right, right.
So is that what really
you're
best
agree,
use
Bill.
Of
I
my
mean,
time?
I'm somewhat of a contrarian, and I try to not rehash what other people are doing, but advance the discussion, advance the debate. And, Bill, you do that, too. I mean, if you look at the stuff you've written at The Week, for example, I mean, you're talking about bringing in, like, how did FDR really handle. So, I mean, that is analysis and bringing in historical examples, but that's not the season we're in right now. I mean, we're in the season of what's the latest thing, the next shoe to drop. You know, the latest, you know, Brett Baer reported that James Rosen's parents' phone was, you know, records or whatever were, I don't want to, were seized or whatever the case may be, that they were eavesdropped on. And so it's like the next
scandal. Well, I haven't tried to piggyback on the whole scandal thing with some historical perspective. The last thing I wrote for The Week was Why Scandal Politics Don't Work. We talked about it a little bit on the show last week, right. And I brought up what happened politically with Iran-Contra and with Clinton impeachment and with Abu Ghraib. Did these things actually politically benefit the prosecuting side? And the answer is no, it didn't.
Right.
I took issue
with you on that, by the way.
You're being a good government person, rule law and all that.
Not where I want to go. I want to say I took issue that you didn't go far enough. Because even the example of Watergate, which is the greatest example of really nailing a president to the wall, even that didn't work out for the Democrats. They controlled the White House, I think, four of the next 18 years. After taking down
that's true, but I would still say Watergate did lead to Jimmy Carter winning, and there were a big, and I think Democrats did very well
in
74.
That's fair.
So I grant you, how far you extend the timeline, how big of a win was that? And it does sort of raise a larger point. Do you really change the fundamental ideological direction of a country if you even get the scandal win? I think a lot of you don't even get the win. Here's one is in a sense where you did, but the country still was moving in the more conservative direction, you know, post LBJ than it was in anyway.
Right.
And it's
sort of like fool's gold, because then the Democrats begin to think that they have a message, whether it's good government or whether it's just that Republicans are corrupt, and so then it disincentivizes them from actually doing the real soul searching that maybe they needed to do, and they didn't get around to doing maybe until until right. years later.
So,
but your story.
But to go back to your original point, yeah. so I did that story and nobody cared. Right. I mean, that didn't get a lot. My Rand Paul piece at the week got a lot more clicks. Well, at least from what I can tell from the Facebook shares and the Twitter stats, that did much better than the scandal one, which has been one of my weaker right. ones at the week. So I think the trajectory of the story is still so early and fresh, and everyone is still so frothing to get the latest data point, the latest revelation, that kind of big picture step back approach doesn't play yet.
Right, but it's been. Here's the point, though, I want to make is, this is a tough environment for us because it's not like this has been a 2-day scandal. We're on week 2. We're almost on week 3 actually of this. And so it's been multiple weeks of the things that we do best, which is analysis, commentary, putting things in context, isn't a commodity that anybody wants. Our competitive advantage has been undermined. And even Bill, when you try to tie in, it wasn't like you were writing about something irrelevant or
right.
You were writing about something that was very relevant, and it still didn't work. And I had a similar thing happen, Bill. Yesterday I wrote about the Hatch Act, which it turns out there are like 2 levels of how governmental employees are treated under the Hatch Act. Some people, like if you're a CIA agent, for example, you can't do anything political. There are parts of the IRS, criminal investigation, that are, further prohibited. So they essentially can't do anything political. But IRS agents can, and I wrote this interesting piece telling this story that most people probably don't realize that the Hatch Act, that there are different levels of how it applies to different governmental employees. And I made the case that maybe IRS agents, should be governed by the stricter branch of the Hatch Act. And so right now you have a situation where you could be an IRS employee who goes door-to-door campaigning for Obama Tuesday, Wednesday goes to a, union rally, and Thursday decides whether or not a conservative gets nonprofit tax-exempt status. And so maybe we should look into that. Guess what? Crickets, Bill. Nobody, I don't even think anybody retweeted it, never mind linked to it.
Well, because you're in the mode where everyone's playing their respective roles now, where if you're on the right, the mainstream media is simply taking any data point they get and breathlessly hyping it. And I would argue, regardless of whether it even makes sense in a scandal context, right. There was this report now that the IRS told Treasury a few weeks prior that this audit was going to be released and that they want to do some kind of public apology first. And apparently the Treasury official said, yeah, maybe that's not such a great idea. But in the end, they said, okay, it's your call. You're the IRS. We don't boss you around. And so this is a headline, Treasury knew 3 weeks before. And you're kind of like, and the report came out. So there's no cover-up. So what is the actual scandal here? Right. So but I guess every little bit is just sort of being presented in this, kind of approach.
But Bill, the other...
That's what the mainstream media is doing. And so the right is out there trying to drive it with the hearings and talk about partisanship and out of control IRS and all that sort of
right.
thing. And the left is playing defense and talking about how this stuff doesn't amount to very much and this is being all overhyped. So that's where everyone else is. And if you're doing something that's not in those respective roles, I would imagine, and obviously for those who are coming on the thread can disabuse us of this.
Well, I'm sure they will.
That we personally suck and it's not about these overall dynamics. But I imagine when you're, spending your time at your cubicle, for your whatever free time you get during the day and you want to check out what's going on, you're following the story,
right.
not casting about for very far field takes on
right.
it because you just want to get to the next page
exactly.
of the thriller, if you will.
Exactly. And often, Bill, there are 3 or 4 or 5 stories sort of out there. There's like maybe a disaster story, and then there's a pop culture story, and there's all sorts of stories usually happening. But for the last 3 weeks, there have been, really 1 or 2. I know we did have the, horrific weather event in Oklahoma, but really it's been political news has been really overshadowed by one. I mean, I count these 3 scandals as one dominant story. And so it's not like there's even a sub story like Jonah Lehrer or, you know, a scandal or whatever that we could sort of talk about. There, you know, the scandals, the Obama scandals, the IRS thing, the AP, the James Rosen story. I mean, all of those White House scandals are just dominating. But, Bill, even when there is room for commentary or analysis, I'm also undercut by the mainstream media who are actually doing their jobs. And so, for example, when somebody like Dana Milbank, who's written some great stuff for The Washington Post, calling out Obama the last couple of days, if he writes it, it's much more interesting. I could have written the same thing, but I'm a conservative, so I'm expected to be critical of Obama. But when the Washington Post, Dana Milbank writes it, there's this man bites dog thing that's happening. And so you have people from the New Yorker or people from...
He has been that dog a lot, I think, though. I agree with you that that's the reaction.
Or there's other people, like people from the New Yorker, for example. Ryan Lizza has written some really hard, you know, tough things about Obama lately. That's man bites dog. And it's much more interesting than if someone from the Daily Caller, you know, Matt Lewis, a center-right journalist or a conservative blogger, whatever you want to call me, if I write something critical of Obama, it could be the exact same thing. It's greeted with a yawn. And yes, I realize this is narcissistic navel-gazing bitching, but this is content. We're giving the audience
I think this raises an interesting point, because I feel like, you know, conservatives could write a story about how we think the mainstream media is doing its job right now. Hooray for mainstream media. They're not completely, it's not a big liberal conspiracy like I thought it was. You know, why is it that they are doing this now when they didn't do it for Salinger or Fast and Furious? I mean, right. I think there's things you could say about that. But I'm not painting you with this brush, but I do think that there are some conservatives that are so committed to the persecution complex and the victimhood dynamic that when and I see this on the left too sometimes, so I'm not saying this is totally the province of conservatives, but when here is a situation where this does show, well, maybe it's not quite as simplistic as I portrayed it before, that doesn't get acknowledged in any way, that the view of the media doesn't get refined or nuanced in any way. I mean, I remember when, you know, Ann Coulter got this puff piece cover story on her, and instead of just basking in the glow, she goes on a 5-day media tour complaining about the photograph on the cover, saying this proves that the media is still biased. So she could not let go the narrative that the media is out to get her when they just gave her a big sloppy wet kiss. And I think there are plenty of times on the left too. Again, not just to pick on conservatives when there have been, you know, tough pieces on conservatives or balanced approaches to how they dealt. I mean, look, I think that the way the media handled Salinger and Fast and Furious on net was pretty good. They tend to write more balanced stories and did not get into this overly breathless mode with every revelation. I could complain about certain stories, but I don't think the overall narrative, I thought, was much more calmer. And to the right, of course, that's evidence of how the media is in the tank. But they can't both be right. I don't want to get
into this too much, but I would say I think there are two caveats to this. One, the media is being targeted now. The AP seizure of phone records, spying on James Rosen, calling him a co-conspirator. So I think the media has a vested interest and incentive to take interest in this now. And I also think that in a second term, this is one of the hazards of being a lame duck, where all of a sudden it's in your best interest if you're a reporter. You no longer have to worry so much about playing the access game. It now maybe becomes in your best interest to start vetting the president. You can't cost him re-election anyway. To start, maybe make a name for yourself, maybe make a legacy. And so I think that there are some less noble reasons why the press all of a sudden is starting to do their job. But it's just unfortunate, and I'm happy that they are, but it makes my life a little harder in terms of every day. I have to write something, multiple things every day. And like I said, you know, I have a sort of a competitive advantage. There's certain things that I feel like I'm good at, and you and I in many ways have similar skill sets, and the way that things have kind of come together in the last couple of weeks, Matt Lewis' hardest hit, That's all we have to say. Scandal, Matt Lewis Hartzell.
Well, from the vantage point of the left, I mean, the left has, the blogging left has been very shaped by the Karl Rove style politics of the Bush years. And, you know, part of the reason why the liberal bloc came into being was to, grab Democrats by the collar and say, you don't understand how it works anymore. You don't understand how the media works anymore. You don't understand how the way Republicans are playing the game anymore. You have to be much more aggressive, to respond to charges. You have to be much more, coordinating your messaging, and you have to, put your game face on. And I think, to a large extent that has been correct, although I think some evidence in recent years do challenge the premises. But putting that aside, I think there is there's a comfort level on the left to engage in this sort of fight that is not the same as how do we work with Obama to pass legislation that is inevitably going to be compromised in some way to get through the process of Congress? That's not as exciting a task. So I think a lot of folks kind of like being in the trenches. How do we counterspin every scandal element? Because it's in some ways it's less about protecting Obama than it is about mocking the media, mocking the right.
I
personally have less of an interest in that. I have more of an interest on the legislative side.
Right.
So I get just kind of tired with defending every little ticky tack thing. So I am not as inclined to jump into that, and I am not as professionally dependent on clicks right now. So I mean, if I take a couple of days off and don't write, like I still get paid.
Right.
You have a different situation where you gotta write multiple things every day, no matter what.
Well, and this is my pressure is all internal. I don't have anybody like Lewis, damn it, give me a 500-word copy. I don't have that, but I have this internal. As long as I have a blog, not a column, but a blog, I feel that it's incumbent upon me to provide a certain amount of content to justify me having a blog. And I take vacation and stuff sometimes, but I mean, by and large, as a rule, I go to work whether it's a good day or a bad day. I show up and find something to write about, whether I feel like it or not. And frankly, I think that's one of I recently at the week talked about another piece that went nowhere. I wrote advice for 2013 graduates, like if I were giving a commencement speech, which I was really proud of, and I think I got like two comments. Some of the advice I would give is if you want to be a professional at this, you don't wait until you're inspired. You're not going to be inspired every day. You show up and you do the job and you write and you find something to write about. And, whether it's breaking news or opining, whatever, I mean, luckily I have a lot of tools in my toolbox that I can use. You do it whether you feel like it or not every day. But some days are harder than others. And I think, Bill, when you're talking about the left and the blogging left, I think it's interesting that sometimes you can work yourself out of a job. I feel like that there was a time and a season for the left to be on blogs and to push the party and the movement. And they're now sort of a victim of their success. And I'm sure some of the people who were blogging and making a name for themselves 10 years ago are out of the game now because they sort of became irrelevant. And for me, as someone who sees this as a calling and a career, that's not acceptable. You adapt and overcome. And you will find a way to keep writing and keep staying relevant and enduring through the good times and the bad, whether the environment favors you or not. And that's, one of the differences between, I think, people who make it and people who don't is that, and it's so cliched, but it's people who make it just don't quit writing. Right now, I'm sure that so many in the audience are thinking, well, this should be such a ripe time I think it's ironic that at this time when people are tuning in, and let me just, and then I'll shut up, Bill, but I will say this. I think that right now, this, you know, if you're a TV pundit, this is a time to make a name for yourself, because there are people who start tuning in, whether it's the Monica Lewinsky scandal or whatever. I think there are people who start tuning in to cable news, and I bet you if you were to do a study of people who kind of break into the cable TV pundit game, it happens, O.J. Simpson trial, that's when, you know, Tucker Carlson, my boss, sort of broke in during that, believe it or not. Monica Lewinsky, when those scandals hit, it is a ripe time for TV pundits. But for me, where I'm at today, it actually poses challenges.
But you at least have, you know, you have a perch already. You know, you don't have to break in yet. You're already there. And you have your, I think you have an expectation. You're not expected to be the scandal monger. You're expected to give more of a big think, long view with your writing. So I don't personally see you as being in any kind of professional jeopardy, because eventually, you know, the DEFCON 1 style right. coverage has to fade eventually. Other stories will have to come into play, and then you'll be back where you are. You just have to slog through
this annoying time. I have to tell myself that. I mean, look, I worked at going through college, I worked at a gas station for 5 years. In the back of my head, I'm always thinking I can't, by the way, the gas station's closed. And I think there's a KFC there now, so I can't really go back to the gas station, but I'm always like a little bit afraid, looking over my shoulder, and maybe like newspapers are shutting down. I just feel there's always this pressure, I think, and there should be this pressure to be advancing the story and, sort of rationalizing your employment, that why are you privileged to get to write about stuff? It's an honor, and there are a lot of people who would like to be able to do it, and many of them are probably more talented than me, so I damn sure better keep working at it.
So are you click dependent? I mean, are you judged regularly on how many clicks your stories are getting?
Well, I think at the end of the day, everybody is, but no one's ever said it to me, and I don't even know or pay attention to it, but I think even if I'm not click dependent, I am dependent on sort of driving the debate. So it's possible that there could be a small number of opinion leaders who read my stuff, and that creates buzz on Twitter. But that's not even happening in the last couple of weeks, Bill. Like, it's nothing. It's, you know, these things. And let's just move, let me bring up, this is a good time to maybe segue. Let me tell you a couple of the stories I've written about this week. I know you've got things to say about them, too. And let's start in Virginia, my adopted home state where I live now, the Commonwealth of Virginia, where there was a convention. And the Republicans, because it was a convention, not a primary, they picked this African-American pastor named, is it E.W. Jackson? Is that right?
I think that's right.
And I'll let you talk about how controversial he is. Some of the things that he said were controversial. But what I pointed out was that it's been a long time. It's been about a dozen years since an African-American ran statewide in the Commonwealth of Virginia. And at the same time that happened, Terry McAuliffe, the Democratic gubernatorial nominee, and I should mention that my wife Erin, whom you've now met, Bill, you've met her many times, but the audience has met, previously consulted for the Republican gubernatorial candidate, but not today, but I should disclose that. But Terry McAuliffe, a dozen years ago, referred to blacks as, quote, colored people, which I think is interesting given the fact that he now faces a ticket which includes, an African-American running for lieutenant governor. So I wrote about that, and once again, Bill, crickets. Nobody interested. Did not generate any interest. So I'd love to get your take on that. And also, what is the left saying about this? Pastor
You know, I mean, I think there are folks on the left who are very focused on this. I think at any time there's a chance to highlight, someone on the extreme right, someone who seems crazy, someone who seems like a not serious statewide candidate that's right in the left's wheelhouse. And I think the biggest incendiary thing that I'm aware of is that he equated Planned Parenthood with the KKK. In fact, said that Planned Parenthood has killed more black babies than the KKK did. That stuff really just pushes, the left's buttons. And considering that Virginia has become a pretty purple state, and ever since George Allen lost after the Macaca episode, the Republicans who have won the Republicans have not been able to win a Senate seat since then. And they have the governorship now, but he definitely had to sand off the rough edges on the social issues to win that seat and focus very much on economic issues to win. And the way the Virginia Attorney General was prosecuting Obamacare in the run-up to 2012 would seem to have not really helped the Republicans, in the presidential campaign. So I would imagine that this is, I don't know how Republicans feel about it, but certainly the left feels like here's a chance to show that, whatever frustrations you might currently have about where Obama's going, where the Democrats are, about the economy, whatever, these guys are out to lunch. Right. These guys have not figured out how to recalibrate and become seriously competitive again. So I think that issue is one that I see resonating on the left more. I imagine the right is not talking about it as much because their hot hand is the scandals and not their internal intra-party scuffles.
But I would have thought, Bill, that that somebody would have picked up my piece about Terry McAuliffe's comments, even if it was Republicans or conservatives. And tied it in.
I mean,
and I know it's old news, but it wasn't really highlighted, and it's now relevant, I think. The fact that we have this historic candidate on the Republican side makes it, I think, at least worth mentioning, and that didn't happen.
Well, okay, so here you are. You're a Republican, conservative activist. You're looking for things to spread and to tweet out and whatnot. You got the IRS thing, on the run. And so contrast that with a McAuliffe quote from 11 years ago,
I guess you're right.
Which at the time, I mean, it's not like McAuliffe was saying a racial slur. He wasn't. The context of his remarks were not white people are better than colored people. He said he simply should have said people of color, not colored people. It's a classic Bloom County. You remember that Bloom County when they go back and forth about what the politically correct term is, and they go from people of color to colored people. They're like, no, that's wrong.
Well, I think the other thing that we have working against us is, or that I have working against me, and getting that story to catch on, was principled conservatives. That I only got a few comments on this piece, but a lot of it was conservatives saying, that used to be a commonly used term. What's the big deal? It's the NAACP.
Well, that's not the strongest argument.
They're essentially taking McAuliffe's side rather than playing politics. They're taking this principled, even if you think it's misguided, this sort of principled stance, defending McAuliffe. These people when
I guess that sort of fits like we're not going to play the PC game.
Yeah, exactly. But let me just say, I think that the fact is this Virginia race has been overshadowed and in its own right, it's an interesting story. I mean, Terry McAuliffe obviously ran the DNC really tight with Bill Clinton. On the Republican side, you have Ken Cuccinelli at the top of the ticket, who is in some ways controversial, but also seen as a conservative rock star, who's the attorney general running. He's the current attorney general running for governor. The man running for Attorney General, Openshain, his father was the U.S. Senate nominee in 1977, died in a plane crash before he could win the election, which he would have won, and that's how John Warner got to be a U.S. Senator. And now you have, however many years later, 30 some years later, his son, in the same building where he received the Republican nomination for the U.S. Senate, his son now receives a nomination for Attorney General. And then you have this, you know, the first African-American statewide, you know, running for statewide office in a dozen years. That's a legitimate story. It's an interesting story. And, you know, it's an odd year. Virginia, you know, usually whoever wins the presidency, Virginia goes the other way the next year. And so, you know, Chris Christie is going to win easily in New Jersey. So this Virginia gubernatorial race is you know, one of the only electoral stories. And it's right next door if you are in D.C. And I don't think it's gotten much attention. And it's certainly not going to get any attention this week.
Not this week, but I do. But because of all the elements that you say, certainly as you get into the fall, all political eyes are going to be on this because it is the only kind of marquee collection of state races out there in 2013. So I don't think it's bad. So this is the kind of situation where if I were you, I'd say, you know, maybe I'm going to write about Virginia not because it's going to get a lot of attention today, but maybe I'm going to establish myself as the go-to Virginia observer, and it benefits you actually live in Virginia so you can really watch it up close. If you become known as owning that Virginia story over the course of the time and you were doing it ahead of the curve, that might lead to future attention, you know, going forward. So you got to – this is where I have a hard time professionally being – just ahead of the curve enough. I often might write things that are like way ahead,
yeah,
6 months ahead, and then I feel like, oh, I'm owning this story, and then it actually breaks big, and no one cares what I wrote about 6 months prior.
It's so weird.
I'll find a way to jump in.
There is such a thing as being too far ahead of the curve. There really is.
Right. But I do think I imagine it's going to behoove you to stay on top of Virginia. Now, you also wrote, the other thing you wrote about this week was about immigration, which, you know, arguably is the marquee legislation of the year, perhaps the last big item on the Obama legacy agenda. And I think this story has been sort of churning for weeks now as it slowly plods through the legislative process under unusually regular order. And yet all the blow-by-blow of this is not getting people's attention for the most part, but you weighed in this week.
Yeah, well, it is – first of all, it is getting difficult. After the Senate Judiciary Committee yesterday passed passed it on, a crowd in the audience started chanting "Si se puede," yes we can, which makes it really unhelpful if you're a conservative who supports immigration reform. and I had a piece yesterday where Bill Kristol, appearing on Laura Ingraham's radio show, said that Rubio should walk away from it, which was interesting because Bill Kristol has been in the past thought of as a self-described liberal on immigration. So Bill, I wanted to read you just the last paragraph that I wrote about Bill Kristol and get your comment. Here's what I wrote. Ultimately, it seems like Kristol is in favor of immigration reform, but only theoretically. He's in favor of it in a magical world where Republicans control everything and don't need any Democrats to buy in. But as soon as there's a chance a realistic bill could actually pass, he reverts back to the fears of all the things that might go wrong. And this is why it's so hard to pull this off. The default position, the safe position for conservative pundits, is always to torpedo immigration reform, and so it continues. And so it continues, Bill.
I don't get Kristol's motivation here. I mean, he's already stuck his neck out, you know, a while back, saying I'm a liberal on immigration. That's good for the Republican Party to put this issue to rest. Now the bill is on the verge of becoming law. what's career logic, what political logic do you have to walk away? I mean, he's saying that, so he said on Laura Ingraham's radio show that Rubio should step away from the big government bill and deal with the matter issue by issue rather than one comprehensive piece of bad legislation. Quote, think of the trust you have to have in the bureaucracy to make this all work. There'll be certifications of border security. There'll be tests whether people paid back taxes. I mean, what do you think legislation is?
Right. Well, again, I think it's this magical world where Republicans could do it unilaterally. But, you know, even if Republicans controlled the presidency, the House, and the Senate, the notion that they could pass immigration reform piece by piece, even assuming all that, it is still a heavy lift. And would you even want to do something that's that big, not in bipartisan fashion? But, Bill, I think there are a couple reasons why Crystal's doing this. One, I think you cannot overlook the pressure from the base to be against immigration reform. It's intense pressure if you're a conservative pundit wanting to be popular.
But Crystal often goes against the grand stuff like this. I just don't get why I would work on Crystal.
Well, and I think that there are a couple of other things happening. One, I think Crystal wants to deprive Obama of any sort of victory. And
well, that's Crystal's MO. I can see that.
But I think the scandals play into it. For example, the scandals put Obama on the ropes. Why would you want to throw him a lifeline? Why would you want to change the subject? Why would you want to give him a win, especially now that we have him on the ropes on Benghazi, on the AP, on the IRS, all that stuff? But I also think that the scandals raise, one of my last pieces for the week was a conservative defense of government, which was very ill-timed, Bill. Almost as poorly timed as your piece about how scandals won't impact Barack Obama's second term.
Or that Obama's not a lame duck, right?
That's what it was. I'm sure you stand by everything you wrote, and I stand by everything I wrote.
I do.
But it was still very poorly timed in the sense that I think people were not going to be as open to my argument. And my argument was essentially that although I don't believe in big government and I don't believe in bureaucracy, government is important. And a lot of times we talk...
Immigration control is done by the government. I mean, if you're a libertarian, if you believe the government should be about immigration, then you're for open borders and then there's no system at all. Everyone just walks across. I mean, that's what you believe. But
right, exactly. I was no making a conservative case against the libertarian case, essentially. I mean, it was what I was doing. Now, it got misconstrued by some as me being, like, in favor of big government, which I'm not. But in any event, I think this plays into Bill Crystal, because he's saying, look, we obviously can't trust the government. And Joe Scarborough said the same thing. You know, he was pushing for background checks, and even he said that these scandals undermine his effort. As a Republican trying to push something, putting his neck on the line, the Obama scandals undermined his effort for gun gun control and background checks, which I opposed. But in any event, I think that Bill Crystal is saying, in lieu of these scandals, where obviously the federal government can't be trusted, why should we pass some big immigration reform and give them more power? And I would argue what we have right now is de facto amnesty. Well, read my piece. I made a lot of arguments, but I think that's what Bill Crystal is seizing on.
I can accept Crystal doesn't want to give Obama the win. I mean, that I feel like is in line. I mean, that's how Crystal, you know, was the main person to stop Hillary care, saying, you know, we just can't. You can't give him a win. Period. No matter what the compromise is, you just got to block it.
Right. But that mentality, as you know, Bill, is part of the problem. Democrats, when George W. Bush was president. Don't forget, it was Byron Dorgan introducing a poison pill that brought down the 07 effort, and Barack Obama and Jim DeMint were part of that effort in killing immigration reform. in a very sneaky way, and they wanted to deprive, you know, George W. Bush from doing it. And I think that that's not the right thing to do. You do something, you oppose something or support something because it's good policy, and it's, you know, they did it to us, and now we do it to them, and it's a cycle, a vicious cycle.
Well, but I feel like, I mean, I don't completely accept the premise there, but I mean, that amendment was proposed and it did bring the bill down. But I think a lot of the, you know, the run up to that, you know, I don't think the pieces were really in place. I don't think the stakeholders really had their arms locked in at that point. And I mean, the reason why the bill got put in was that, you know, the unions and the Chamber of Commerce just were not there. And now they are. Or it might get upset by the latest wrinkle that happened with the Hatch Amendment, but we've gone as far as we have because there's been this very patient coalition building process that I think is farther along than where we were in 2007. And what strikes me as interesting about the developments this week is all the scandal stuff has not derailed the bill. The bill has cleared the Judiciary Committee with three Republican votes. So there's Ed Hatch and Flake and Lindsey Graham. So that is I think a little less than I forget how many people are on the Judiciary Committee on the Republican. I think it's eight. So you're a little less than half of the Republicans on the committee voting for, which is not too shabby. And you know, they're shooting for getting around 20 or so, I think, on the full floor. And they very much wanted to get Hatch's vote to go beyond the Gang of Eight, beyond the four Republicans in the Gang of Eight. And Hatch made his price an amendment which somewhat upsets the union chamber compromises today in terms of how tech companies, when can they hire foreign workers for higher paying jobs is a different issue than the agricultural jobs that we usually talk about with immigration. I know the Apple CEO is blasting the deal, but they didn't go as far as saying, let's kill the bill. So my guess is that this is not a deal killer, even though it's going to produce some agita. So the bottom line is the bill's moving forward, despite the fact, and then this goes back to the piece I wrote for the week that no one read. Usually, if you can't get a big political win out of pushing scandal, you don't force the president out of office. It doesn't lead to a big electoral payday come the next election. At minimum, it's a plausible goal to scuttle the agenda, to distract the White House, to soak up the oxygen. But does it make sense in this case? Because a lot of Republicans share Obama's immigration goal, and that's the big agenda.
And who pays? And who pays the price for this? I mean, If Republicans kill immigration reform, they get de facto immigration, they keep a broken system, and they will be blamed politically. So
right. So the political dynamics and the policy dynamics have not changed. I get your point that there are some people like Crystal who might be seeing blood in the water and they're shifting, but I think in the big scheme of things, the political dynamics have not changed. The same Republicans who won it before still won it for the same reasons. They're still on track to get a sizable bipartisan vote in the Senate. I mean, it's a certainty, but they're following the path that they had laid out for themselves. And if they get, 70 votes in the Senate, that puts very big pressure on Boehner to accept that bill as is, and not because Crystal was talking about doing it piece by piece. That's what the House Judiciary Committee Chair says he wants to do, which everyone knows is a recipe to kill it, because it's not going to pass piece by piece, and it would take too long. You get into the election season next year, and then no one's going to vote for it. This is the window now where you're far enough removed from the election where you might get a bipartisan vote, and you got to move quickly to fit that window.
I mean, as Jeff Flake told me when I interviewed him, you know, it needs to be comprehensive to get the things that conservatives want. It's very important for Flake to have stronger border security, and they couldn't have passed that, you know, in an ad hoc sort of, you know, alone.
This is the essence of compromise. You get something you want, I get something I want, we vote for it together at the same time.
That sounds unseemly, but I mean, that's what politics is.
That's how democracy functions everywhere. So if you're not going to accept like the basic premise of how, I mean, if you didn't believe in that, you wouldn't have congresses. You just vote for a single president, and that person would just issue decrees.
Well, and that's why
you
I said
have that, congresses.
Bill Kristol, I think, is one among the conservatives who have theoretically want to tell their friends at the cocktail party that they're for immigration reform if those politicians just don't screw it up. But you can't just theoretically be for it. I mean, obviously, if the bill is bad, the bill is bad. But it strikes me that there are the sort of segment of conservatives who are only for it in this magical utopian universe where Republicans get everything they want, Democrats get nothing, and it's done unilaterally. That you might as well say you're against it because it's never going to happen.
Or you can wait till the day comes when you have, you know, full control of both chambers of commerce and the presidency. And some people always want to make that play and wait for that magical
and
day.
And then the other side torpedoes
right.
I mean, because they're waiting for their day.
You'd have to be a clear 60.
Here's the fundamental problem, though. You got to think, what's in it for the other guy? And if we're all just doing things, I mean, so let's say Republicans had everything. Democrats could then play the same game. We're not going to pass immigration reform until we've got control of government. So let's find a way to kill it. So then nothing gets done.
Right. I mean, that's – but my hopeful take is – I mean, I think there's some people playing that game, but the hopeful take is this is on track of getting done still. And I think it's – the good odds are this will be the last element of the Obama legacy and a further breaking of the gridlock fever that he was hoping for, that it does prove that the system still works, the two parties can function side by side, and Republicans, and it's not to say it's all about Obama, but the Republicans will get to say, look, we are a different party than the Pat Buchanan anti-immigration party that you've known over the past several years, and Latino voters, you should take a good look at us again and realize that we're a different animal now. So I think both sides will get legitimate wins out of this, and the scandal stuff. And as we talked about last week, as Mickey Kaus predicted, this might actually help immigration reform by distracting folks and letting this amendment process grind out without every move sparking, you know, massive outrage every second.
It will be interesting to see if it's a
it is actually interesting. It's actually an interesting process.
It is.
With a lot of drama, but nobody cares. Because I think people are still the twists and turns of the H-1B visa doesn't get the kind of clicks that a scandal.
And let me just
operates.
Say, Bill, that is why this is the second favorite show of that guy that you met, because we cover not the best, but second best at covering these kind of stories that are being ignored. And so we're second, so we try harder, is all I can say. That's what you get here.
Well, I need to jump. I have to run to a meeting. I'm a very busy man.
I know you are. All right, well, good show, and until next time, have fun, and thanks for visiting us in the DMZ.